Welcome to the PRI Review, brought to you by the Population Research Institute. I'm your host, Christopher Mannion. President Trump's nomination of Judge Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court has aroused opposition from the usual suspects. Having worked on hundreds of nominations myself in the Reagan years, I offer, in the form of a letter to Judge Kavanaugh, my observations on how he might want to proceed as his nomination hearings approach. Congratulations, Judge Kavanaugh. And now, brace yourself. And pray hard. There are malevolent forces at large in the land who want to ruin you. I speak, alas, from experience. I staffed confirmation hearings for several disputed nominations in the Judiciary Committee in the 1980s. I served on kill boards at Justice, prepping judicial nominees in practice sessions for their real hearings. Virtually every respectable nominee comes to his hearing somewhat nervous, even awed. Yes, a few are contemptuous, like the deep state figures from the Department of Justice and the FBI these days, but most nominees are respectful. After all, they are there to get confirmed. They are respectful, but unfortunately not all senators are. You might remember in 1987 when Robert Bork's surname became a verb. Ralph Neese, a Catholic classmate of mine from Notre Dame, ran the campaign to destroy Judge Bork. His assault was so effective that Ted Kennedy called Ralph the 101st senator. No holds barred, the Senate Judiciary Committee was a free fire zone, shoot to kill. Yes, there were vulgarities then, too, especially when Senator Kennedy tried to sink Robert Bork in the muck of Watergate. Speaking of aquatic images. Fake news? Sure, the media hacks celebrated that smear without ever bringing up Kennedy's abandoning Mary Jo Kopechne to the muck of Chappaquiddick. For now, Judge Kavanaugh, you are the left's public enemy number one. The vulgar vampires of the media will interview childhood neighbors, always looking for slime. They will analyze your high school yearbook. Finding your classmates on social media will be a cinch. And because these swine are lazy, they will let Facebook do their dirty work for them. Which classmates have pages bragging about their abortions? Which ones abound in cesspool language regarding the president? Sooner rather than later, faux recollections of your youthful rigidity, your lack of inclusiveness, and your racism will be front page news. Undoubtedly, you had to suffer through classes from left-wing professors at Yale. Rest assured, they will suddenly remember you vividly, not for your stellar academic performance, but for your subtle but endemic homophobia, your unwillingness to consider other points of view, and of course your rude and peremptory treatment of those with whom you disagree. Did you have a roommate in college? The New York Times will be glad to send a reporter to sleep with him. Or her, hey, come on, this is war, in order to gather unsavory information about your personal habits. The Washington Post will be glad to gather lies, confirmed by two sources, of course, that will never be retracted when the lie is exposed, of course. Did you work for a law firm, for the government? Undoubtedly, your colleagues included many Democrats. You are now serving on an appeals court packed with left-wing judges by Obama. Rest assured, some left-wingers who clerked for those colleagues will be willing to share sordid fabrications with the fake news magnates. And that's only the first wave of the sewer tsunami. The second will come when you begin to make the rounds in the Senate. Many Senate staffers are lazy, too. They will rely on information that zealous radicals in the field dig up about you. Don't you remember how Robert Bork was confronted with an unpaid parking ticket he had received while teaching at Yale? And how Ted Kennedy mocked him for going to work as a private lawyer and making so much money? Greedy money grubber, how can we expect such a swine to care about justice for the little people? You know what? It was only Joe Biden, God bless him, who pointed out that Judge Bork had done so only because he needed to pay the medical bills of his wife who was dying of cancer. Ted Kennedy just shifted in his seat and frowned. The opposition will pore over every word you wrote in the public record. They will also try to procure confidential internal memos from friendly clerks and staff. And of course, they'll attest that you are pompous and rude. And then they will watch you like a hawk. No, like a vulture. Every night, opposition staffers will gather in an obscure Senate conference room and compare what you said today with what you said yesterday. They will then use your own words to try to trip you up or even to contradict yourself tomorrow. And this is important, so listen. You must be wary even of staffers working for senators who will vote for you and who say they support you. Rest assured, many of those staffers consider their positions to be merely a stepping stone to a greater career. They know where their bread is buttered. On the left side, they will feign confidential support and encourage you to relax and have an actual friendly discussion, and then walk across the hall in the Senate Dirksen building to feed the vipers on the other side of the aisle. You must watch every word. Consider the senators. That's what they do, isn't it? Remember Mitt Romney in 2012? Some left-wing twit complained that he wasn't answering her questions. He said, more or less, "Hey, you get to ask your questions, I get to give my answers." Commit that to memory. Then comes the hearing, or rather the hearings. Like the Stasi in East Germany, they will try to tire you out, badger you, surprise you, confuse you, lie to you. They will even smile as they attempt to insert the poisoned stiletto. They will scour the countryside for another third-rate loser like Anita Hill to slander you. Be prepared. Your enemies on that dais will use every wicked wile to conjure up an Achilles heel. Remember, they are pirouetting for the biggest audience they've ever had, because millions will be watching. They are there for themselves, Judge, not for you. You have got to be there for yourself, not for them. Surprise question from left field? There's a pitcher of water in front of you, and this has worked many times with nominees that I have shepherded through their hearings. Use that pitcher of water. Pour it into your glass. And by the way, before the hearing, tell the committee clerk to make sure there's always an extra glass there that's empty. Pour it slowly. Take a sip. Those 10 seconds of silence will seem like an eternity, but it will put you in charge and give you time to give a considered answer rather than a stunned reaction to their slur. Count on it, the pressure will rise. Democrats will move to postpone a vote in the Judiciary Committee. They will undoubtedly filibuster your confirmation vote on the floor. That will go on for weeks. Be careful. Just because your hearings are over doesn't mean they've stopped watching and listening. They will follow your every move. Screaming viragos in pink hats will confront you on the street. Minority staffers will shout vulgarities at you in the Senate corridors, just like they have in these past weeks. Some harridan will try to stick her face in yours and scream. It's all a setup. Their cameras will be rolling. One false move, one unstudied word, and they've got you. Judge, keep your cool. Keep your cool. Their hatred is hot. Your cool will douse it like a waterfall pouring down on the wicked witch of the East. And pray, don't forget to pray. And ask your friends to pray. I recall one judicial nominee who was ultimately confirmed by one vote in the Senate. He was amazed when he learned, years later, that a group of women in a faraway state had been fasting and praying for him all day every Monday for months. Judge, you will ultimately be confirmed. Congratulations. But remember, a new monster will then confront you, the lust for power, the libido dominandi, the ancients called it. That temptation will last a lifetime. Don't stop praying. This is PRI Review from pop.org. We'll be right back. Do you want to win pro-life legislative and political battles? For years, PRI has been helping pro-life leaders on the ground around the world to win legislative and political battles in order to protect the lives of the unborn. And now we're asking for your help so we can continue this vital work. Let me tell you more. In a number of countries around the world, there are still pro-life laws on the books. But the Planned Parenthood Abortion Liberales Malthusians are out there to get rid of those laws. Nearly 5 years ago, the Pontifical Council on the Family asked PRI to be the main organization to help the pro-life movements around the world to be more effective. In response to the Vatican's request, we created our Pro-Life Victory Seminars and our Pro-Life Strategy Guide. The seminars are grueling, demanding 12 to 14-hour intense working sessions. Only the most proven and successful leaders are invited to speak. Only the best and the most committed activists are invited to attend. To date, we have conducted 60 such sessions in 18 countries. We have trained more than 1,700 people who are serious about protecting the unborn in their respective countries. They have won some victories, but I'm not going to tell you about those because I don't want to put a target on the back of those leaders. I'm not going to tell you the names of their countries either because I don't want to make it even harder for them to do their work. But here's a hint. Most, though not all, have Spanish as their native tongue. It's no secret that south of our border, pro-abortionists are zeroing in on the existing pro-life laws in that part of the world. I cannot tell you the battle stories, although there are many, without endangering the victories of the leaders. I must ask you to take my word that some battles in some countries could not have been won without the training and support received from PRI. What kind of training am I talking about? Everywhere in the world, defenders of life need everything: strategic thinking skills, campaign skills, legislative skills, lobbying skills, to protect their pro-life laws and to stop pro-death initiatives. Around the world, we found that the biggest thing lacking is know-how. By that, I mean political sophistication. Here in America, we've been fighting pro-life battles for almost 50 years, and while we haven't won definitively, we have learned a lot about how to fight, as well as how not to fight. One of the most important tools of our pro-life victory training is the manual that the trainees get to take home with them, the Pro-Life Strategy Guide, the guide to winning pro-life battles. Think of it as a field guide to activism. The guide is a compendium of know-how. It is 200 pages of distilled experience and wisdom, with step-by-step instructions about how to advance our issue in a representative landscape. Here's a small sampling of the know-how delivered in these training sessions. How to raise money, how to lobby legislators, how to write powerful pro-life advertising, how to effectively appear on TV and radio, how to enlist volunteers, how to get out the vote, and how to successfully debate pro-abortionists. All this and much, much more is covered in the training program and reinforced in the training guide. The first edition came out in 2012, but we are all out of them now. They have all been put in the hands of able pro-life leaders. So today, we have had it revised and updated by two of the best and most successful activists in the Spanish-speaking world. Today, the new PRI, Pro-Life Strategy Guide, the guide to winning pro-life battles, is ready to go to press. This is where you come in. Will you help us get it into the hands of the people who need it? It's in Spanish right now, and that's as it should be, because we distribute it throughout the Spanish-speaking world. The Vatican wants this field manual in every diocese in the world. Will you help me to fulfill that request? PRI has ordered 10,000 copies of the guide to be printed, enough for every student who will attend our training sessions for the next several years, along with all the actively pro-life bishops around the world. Just the printing alone will cost $50,000. The whole International Victory Training Program costs another $50,000, and that is in addition to the field guide. But right now we want to get those guides printed. So I turn to you because I know you understand its value. The cost comes out to about $5 per book, which is not very much considering the impact it can have and the lives it can save. With your tax-deductible gift of $50, PRI can put this guide into the hands of 10 in-country pro-life leaders. With a gift of $100, we can make sure that 10 friendly bishops get a copy to guide their strategic thinking in the protection of life. No gift is too small. If you can only spare $5, please send it today. Unborn babies around the world will be safer because of your sacrifice today. Can we count on you to help PRI to continue to train and empower the pro-life movement around the world? On behalf of all those fighting to preserve pro-life laws around the world, thank you. One of the wisest commentaries on the Kavanaugh nomination comes from a curious source. David Carlin was once the Democrat majority leader in the Rhode Island State Senate. He has since become a celebrated professor and has authored several books on the Catholic Church. Today, we share with you his observations on the nomination. David Carlin. President Trump has nominated Brett Kavanaugh to the United States Supreme Court, and the American political cultural left has freaked out. They have freaked out for many reasons, among them that this nomination may mean, at least for a few decades, a retreat from the idea that we have a living Constitution. In plain English, this is the noxious idea that the Supreme Court is free to legislate from the bench, or, more to the point, is free to amend the Constitution. If you read the Constitution according to its more or less plain meaning, it is not, and never was intended to be, a living thing. Instead, it is a social contract first written in 1787 and amended many times since then. It is not a thing analogous to a vegetable or an animal which develops in a natural way. Rather, it is akin to a building that adds rooms or knocks down walls according to the wishes of the owner of the building. But the more immediate reason for the freakout is that the left fears, indeed it is terrified, that putting the Trump nominee on the court will sooner or later result in an overturn of the Roe v. Wade ruling of 1973, the notorious ruling that found a right to abortion in the U.S. Constitution. Roe was one of the worst rulings in the history of the Supreme Court, in the same league with Dred Scott and Plessy v. Ferguson, and a court with Kavanaugh on it may well decide to acknowledge this. If Roe is overturned, the question of abortion rights goes back to the states. Each individual state will be free to permit abortion without restriction, permit it with restrictions, or to ban it. The probable outcome is that hardcore liberal states will permit abortion with few, if any, restrictions, while hardcore conservative states will ban it with few, if any, exceptions. Sadly, states with big Catholic populations, for instance, New York, New Jersey, Illinois, Massachusetts, Connecticut, and California, will probably retain abortion on demand, while those states that severely restrict abortion will be states in which conservative Protestantism is dominant, for instance, Alabama, Mississippi, South Carolina, Tennessee, Arkansas, Missouri, South Dakota, Utah, which is Mormon, will, of course, restrict abortion. If you live in Alabama and you want an abortion, you might have to take a bus to New York and rent a motel room for a few days. When the Democrats once again get control of both houses of Congress plus the White House, something that will eventually happen, the federal government will probably seek to pay for that bus plus the motel for the poor pregnant Alabama girl. Why does the left care so much about abortion? Why do they regard it as absolutely horrible that abortion may not continue to be and what it never should have been, a constitutional right? Is it because they themselves frequently become pregnant in an accidental and undesired way? No, that doesn't happen very often. Leftist pro-abortion ideologues are usually intelligent and mature people. And when they have sexual relations and don't want pregnancy to result, they are careful to use contraception. Except for the abortion industry, such as Planned Parenthood, which makes money on each abortion, pro-abortion people get no personal gain from abortion. They believe in it as a matter of principle. They are true believers, and what they believe in isn't exactly abortion. It is something broader and deeper than that. It is a culture of sexual freedom. To maintain that culture, of course, you have to have contraception that is readily available, inexpensive, and effective. But it will never be 100% effective, and so you will also need legalized abortion as a backup. Without legal abortion, the culture of sexual freedom will be jeopardized. Just as the demand for abortion rights is part of a bigger thing, the culture of sexual freedom, so the culture of sexual freedom is itself part of a bigger thing, namely the culture of absolute personal liberty, both sexual and non-sexual. Truly radical leftists believe that the individual person should be free to do whatever he or she wishes, provided the acting person does no obvious harm to others. They dream of a state of nature resembling that of Hobbes, except that the lawless persons living in this ideal state will behave in an amiable way. Instead of human life being solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short, it will be social, prosperous, pleasant, humane, and lengthy. These truly radical leftists are, of course, almost all atheists, for, if God exists, a God who is in some way the author of moral laws, humans will not be truly free, as they understand freedom, to be truly free or morally autonomous, to use a word that is favored by the leftists. We must be free to create our own morality. There is then a leftist worldview or quasi-religion which begins with atheism, leads in turn to moral freedom, which in turn leads to sexual freedom, and ultimately to the right to abortion. If Kavanaugh on the Supreme Court threatens a right to abortion, leftists fear that their whole worldview is threatened. No wonder they are freaking out. Their fear of catastrophe is exaggerated, I believe, though I wish it were not. I wish a Supreme Court justice, simply by reading the Constitution in a non-living way, could reverse the campaign to de-Christianize America, but I don't think this will happen. To the degree that abortion is no longer legally available, the left will likely redouble propaganda efforts about using contraception. Kids will be taught this in school, many already are. Public service announcements on TV will remind us. Liberal clergy will tell us that contraception is a Christian duty. Parents who don't teach this to their children will be looked upon as bad parents. It's heartening that abortion will finally be restricted for decades, but that's only the first skirmish in a much larger battle. Thus far, David Carlin, writing for Crisis Magazine's online web version. This has been PRI Review from pop.org. We'll be right back. What's the best way to celebrate Humanae Vitae's 50th birthday? For most of us, the answer is close to home, and specifically in our own parishes. Here's why. 6 years ago, when Timothy Cardinal Dolan was president of the U.S. Bishops' Conference, he admitted that our bishops have had laryngitis on Blessed Pope Paul's beautiful encyclical. Laryngitis for 50 years! Unfortunately, that's still true for many bishops who are too tied up with the political agenda of their national bureaucracy in Washington. There, issues like global warming, socialized medicine, and federal contracts for the bishops' welfare agencies have dominated the agenda for years, crowding out pro-life efforts and leaving Humanae Vitae an orphan. That doesn't mean that the lay faithful haven't been asking. We have. In fact, pleas to our shepherds have had some heartwarming results in recent months, with several bishops coming forward with strong public defenses of Humanae Vitae. But the real work has to come from the grassroots, and that means the laity, because our busy bishops can't do it alone. They need our support, our encouragement, and our prayers. After all, the pro-life movement started at the grassroots, and its strength has stayed there. Bishops are often supportive of pro-life groups in their dioceses, but few are focused on them. Most chancery staffs spend much more time on immigration, refugees, fundraising, and other programs that receive federal funding. Pro-life efforts receive no federal funding, so pro-lifers have to fend for ourselves. While our bishops have countless distractions, our parish priests know us and we know them. They offer our most reliable source of support and encouragement when it comes to celebrating Humanae Vitae's birthday party. And a wise pastor has a good suggestion on how to make it work. It boils down to this. Instead of telling your pastor, "Father, you ought to do something about this," tell him, "Father, a group of us would like to have a reading group in the parish to study Humanae Vitae. We've got the texts, the commentaries, and all the materials. All we need is some space in the parish one night a week and an announcement in the bulletin to spread the word. Don't worry, we'll do all the work, but we'd love to have your support, and it would be great if you could join us whenever you can." And by the way, a further note from long pastoral experience. Don't ask Father on the way out of Mass. Write him a note and ask him for a few minutes of his time at his convenience. There you'll have his full attention, and he can write down what he remembers of your conversation, and that's impossible when 50 or 100 people are shaking his hand after every service. Writing that letter also gives you the opportunity to pad your pitch with some supporting evidence. In this case, not only the support from bishops, including your own, we hope, but especially referring to the world-class conference that the bishops sponsored in Washington at the Catholic University of America last April. It was thanks to the support from Catholic University's stalwart President John Garvey that this conference came off without a hitch, with the admirable support of the conference offered 3 days of top-notch speakers and presentations, and they're all online. Supporters of Humanae Vitae can cite this national conference as their inspiration for activities throughout the country in the diocesan and parish levels. And here's some great news. Our new website devoted to Humanae Vitae is now online. It's a treasure trove of information for your parish group. Here's how to find it. Go to your website browser and type in humanaevitae.org. No spaces, and remember, the dot is a period. There you will find a treasure trove of information for your parish group. Just go to humanaevitae.org to find not only the masterful history of contraception by Dr. Gonzalo Herranz in 4 languages, and by the way, that's the history of the promotion of contraception against church teaching and natural law for over 100 years. But it also includes the latest news and links in a wide array of resources. We'll be updating the site continually with new reports, materials, and insights from all over the world. In no time, it will be your go-to site for Humanae Vitae news. Remember, just go to humanaevitaeproject.org and enjoy. And please don't forget to support PRI, so that we can keep this project worldwide in 4 languages going until everyone knows the truth about Humanae Vitae. Here's your latest weekly briefing from the Population Research Institute at pop.org. Let's roll back Roe v. Wade. Kennedy vacancy on the Supreme Court provides a historic opportunity. 65 years ago, 7 Supreme Court justices, in a brazen act of judicial activism, read into the Constitution an invented right to abortion on demand. In Roe v. Wade and Doe v. Bolton, the court wiped away dozens of state laws protecting the right to life for the unborn child. Since then, abortion has taken the lives of more than 60 million unborn children in America. Every day, the death toll continues to rise. Justice Anthony Kennedy's retirement from the Supreme Court offers us a unique opportunity to correct this tragic decision. America can once again ensure that the fundamental and inherent right to life for everyone is protected in our nation's judicial system. Over the years, Justice Kennedy has sometimes sided with the court's conservative bloc in upholding limited restrictions on abortion. However, he has voted with the court's liberal bloc in upholding and preserving Roe v. Wade, in saving Obamacare, and in inventing a right to gay marriage. If swing voter Kennedy can be replaced with a solidly pro-life justice, it would be the first time since Roe that a majority of Supreme Court justices would respect the limits that the Constitution places on the federal courts. The most vital of these limits, of course, lies in the Bill of Rights itself. The 10th Amendment reserves to the states and to the people the responsibility to defend life that Roe usurped and then abdicated in one of history's most vivid examples of legislation from the bench. A new constitutional majority on the court would provide a unique opportunity, the first in a generation, to significantly roll back Roe, or perhaps even to vacate it entirely, returning the abortion issue to the states where it lies when Roe v. Wade disappears. President Trump has indicated that he will select a nominee to replace Justice Kennedy from a list of justices he began compiling during the 2016 campaign. The president told reporters on June 29th that he has narrowed that list down to some 5 to 7 judges, at least 2 of whom are women. The president has also indicated that he plans to announce his pick for the Supreme Court on Monday, July 9th. During the final debate of the 2016 election, the president made a famous promise. "I will be appointing pro-life judges," he said. "If we put another 2 or perhaps 3 justices on, then overturning Roe v. Wade would happen automatically, in my opinion." Let's face it, whoever President Trump nominates on July 9th to replace Justice Kennedy will face intense opposition. Pro-abortion advocates are keenly aware that Roe v. Wade is hanging by the frayed thread of a single seat on the court, and Justice Kennedy has now vacated that seat. Last year, Republicans used a precedent established by Democrat leader Harry Reid to change Senate rules. That change allowed Justice Neil Gorsuch to be confirmed to the Supreme Court on a simple majority vote in the Senate. But Republicans can afford to lose only one vote if no Democrat senators join them. Republicans hold a razor-thin 51-49 majority in the Senate, and Arizona Senator John McCain has been away from the Senate floor since December while he undergoes cancer treatment. So today, the GOP's majority stands at a slim 50-49. Who are the Republican undecideds? Well, Senators Susan Collins of Maine and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska often side with the left on abortion. Last year, they voted against a bill that would have not only repealed much of Obamacare, but also denied taxpayer funding to abortion giant Planned Parenthood. Senator Collins has already stated that she will not vote for a Supreme Court nominee that would overturn Roe v. Wade. "I would not support a nominee who demonstrated hostility to Roe v. Wade," she said, which is actually different than voting for one that might overturn Roe v. Wade in the future. But moving right along, that's what she told State of the Union on CNN last week. Alaska's Senator Lisa Murkowski says she's undecided. "Fair enough. We don't yet have a nominee." According to the New York Times, Murkowski has indicated that she will consider a nominee's view on the abortion rights case, but that it alone would not be a litmus test for her choice. Even so, Murkowski has taken a defensive stance to any potential appointee, stating in a press release last week that there is no doubt that the president's nominee to succeed Justice Kennedy can expect exacting scrutiny from the Senate, and that is the standard I will apply in evaluating the nominee. According to Murkowski's official statement, Justice Kennedy did write by the Constitution. Well, in 1992, Justice Kennedy voted to keep Roe v. Wade as the law of the land in PP v. Casey. Does Ms. Murkowski think that he did right by doing wrong? But let's look on the other side of the aisle. Are there any swing Democrat senators? Well, Joe Manchin from West Virginia, Heidi Heitkamp of North Dakota, and Joe Donnelly from Indiana are running for re-election in states comfortably won by Trump during the 2016 election. All three, by the way, are Catholics. And all three voted to confirm Seventh Circuit Judge Amy Coney Barrett after several of their Democrat colleagues scathingly attacked her Catholic faith. How will they vote this time? The folks back home had better let them know how important their support will be. Another question arises. Should a president try to pin his nominee down before he nominates him? After all, although President Trump promised during the campaign to appoint pro-life justices to the Supreme Court, the president has indicated that he would probably not be asking potential nominees about whether they would vote to overturn Roe. They're all saying, don't do that, you don't do that, you shouldn't do that, Trump told Fox News last Friday. But I'm putting conservative people on. Period. Clearly no judge with the proper judicial temperament will predict how he might rule in future cases. In fact, when Judge Antonin Scalia was nominated to the Supreme Court by President Reagan in 1986, he said he wasn't even going to talk about Marbury versus Madison, a vital case decided in 1803, let alone anything that came afterwards. And Scalia was confirmed by a unanimous Senate. We all know that respect for the fundamental and universal right to life is an essential qualification for a Supreme Court justice, indeed for any public official. But history has known that, while being pro-abortion has been a sine qua non for justices appointed by Democrat presidents, Republican presidents have not fared so well. When Reagan became president, he didn't have the legal support of groups like the Federalist Society to give his administration guidance on judicial nominees. That organization was founded by two young law students, David McIntosh and Steve Calabresi, in 1982. Now, since, it has grown into a true powerhouse. And Trump's group of potential nominees has been vetted by seasoned lawyers who closely follow the opinions of every court in the country, both federal and state. Early on, Ronald Reagan didn't have that crucial support. He appointed Sandra Day O'Connor to the court because Chief Justice William Rehnquist liked her. Apparently, they had known each other at Stanford University Law School. Moreover, Barry Goldwater supported her because she was from Arizona. By 1987, pro-lifers had grown up, but so had pro-abortion forces. President Reagan nominated D.C. Circuit Judge Robert Bork to the court in 1987. But Bork was met with a savage campaign from the left. Frankly, he had been warned, but he was unprepared for that vile hostility. Senator Ted Kennedy led the battle in the Senate, assailing Bork, even for going into private practice so that he could pay the medical bills of his wife, who was dying of cancer. Even Joe Biden found that to be over the top. But Kennedy needed outside support, and he found it in Ralph Neese, a Catholic Notre Dame graduate. Neese was the most effective pro-abortion activist of his generation. His legacy, Mr. Justice Kennedy, mind you, has lasted for over 30 years. Mr. Neese's pivotal role demonstrates what one dedicated man can do to change history, for better or worse. President George H.W. Bush nominated Justice Davis Souter because Souter was promoted in a very deceptive campaign run by two key players, pro-abortion Republican Senator Warren Rudman and White House advisor John Sununu. These amoral players supported Souter as a favorite son because they were all from New Hampshire. On such flimsy ground is history made. But the fix was in. Sure enough, Justices O'Connor, Kennedy, and Souter all voted to uphold Roe v. Wade in the 1992 Planned Parenthood v. Casey decision, an unpleasant surprise to pro-lifers at the time, who had been hopeful that, with six new Republican-appointed justices to the bench, Roe would be overturned. Chief Justice Rehnquist and Justices Scalia and Thomas, also Republican appointees, voted to overturn Roe, but Roe was preserved. The result? Tens of millions more unborn lives lost in the quarter century since. Kennedy's damage continued into 2016 in Whole Women's Health versus Hellerstedt. He provided the fifth vote to overturn that Texas law. A reasonable measure, frankly, required abortion clinics to comply with state standards for ambulatory surgical centers and required abortionists to have admitting privileges to a nearby hospital in the event of a medical emergency. And those emergencies arise all too often at abortion clinics. But now, Kennedy is retired. Many conservative commentators have lauded all 25 of President Trump's potential nominees. Should we be concerned? The president has to be very careful if he is to fulfill his pro-life promises. For instance, in a case heard in 2012, Diane Sykes, a judge on the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, voted against defunding Planned Parenthood in Indiana, even though Planned Parenthood was accused of refusing to report cases of rape and sex trafficking. Now, one underlying fact remains in every judicial nomination. We've got to face it. Every judicial nominee who is confirmed, according to Article 3, Section 1, is appointed for life. Once he's on the bench, even the most dedicated pro-life appointee will be subject to unprecedented pressure. Members of the court have great power, but many have huge egos to match. They keep one eye on public popularity and another on their place in the history books. Not all of them keep an eye on the Constitution, unfortunately. In fact, consider Chief Justice Earl Warren, appointed by President Eisenhower in 1953. Warren got his job in exchange for his critical support of Eisenhower in the 1952 GOP nominating convention because Warren ran the California delegation as the governor of California. Justice William Brennan, Eisenhower's next appointee, got his job because Ike's attorney general actually confused Brennan with another New Jersey judge who was a true constitutionalist and thus thought he'd be terrific. On a golfing trip to northern Wisconsin after he retired in 1961, Ike complained that both Warren and Brennan had, and I quote, lied through their teeth when interviewed by the president. Ike called him his two biggest mistakes, but they sat there forever and they changed constitutional history. So we have to be careful. Yes, the president's nominee, if confirmed, might well shape the course of the Supreme Court for decades to come. The court will undoubtedly hear at least one direct challenge to Roe, and frankly, that will probably come sooner than later. Regardless of how well-vetted the nominee is, there is simply no guarantee of his or her performance once confirmed. Pro-life conservatives have been deceived and disappointed in the past with nominees that continue to uphold the tragic Roe decision. We cannot, we dare not, squander this opportunity again. Truly, the lives of countless of the unborn are on the line. This present moment represents a unique opportunity to ensure that right to life for all is respected and protected through law. The president must make good on his promise to appoint solidly pro-life justices to the Supreme Court. This has been your latest weekly briefing from the Population Research Institute at pop.org. Thanks for listening.